Krishna Prasaya Bhutale, Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine, Namaste Saraswati Devi, Gauravani Pracharine, Nirvishesha Srinivadi Paskatarishtare. So I'm going to have Neela chant the mantras for me because my voice is sort of gone. So, and Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Tam Talumulam. Talumulam,
Talumulam,
Pradahantam, Agnivad,
Agnivad,
Gopala, Sunam, Pitaram,
Pitaram,
Jagadguru,
Jagadguru,
Chacharda,
Chacharda,
Sadyo, Tirusak. Shatam
Tirukshaksharam
Tirukshaksharam Bakas Ten Tundena Hantam Punar Abhyapadyata
Abhyapadyata
Tam Talumulam Pradahantam Agnivad
Tam Talam
Gopala Sunnam Pitaram Jagadguru
Jagadguru
Chacharda Sadyo Tiru Shakshatam Bakas Tundena Hantam Punar Abhyapadyata Tam talamulam pradahantam agnivad Gopala sunnam pitaram jagadguru Chacharda sadyo tiru shakshatam bakas Tundena hantum punar abhyapadyata Tam talumulam pradahantam agnivad
Other people
Gopala sunnam pitaram jagadguru Chacharda sadyo tiru shakshatam bakas Tundena hantum punar abhyapadyata.
Okay, other gentlemen, others chanting. Tunde mahantum puna abhyabhadyata. Nuram pradahantam agniva. Ladies, Guru, Guru, Jagat Guru, Talamulam Radahantamagniva. Tam Krishna Talumulam, the root of the throat. Pradahantam, burning. Agnivat, like fire. Gopalasunum, Krishna, the son of a cowherd man. Pitaram, the father. Jagat Guru, of Lord Brahma. Chachcharda, got out of his mouth. Sadhya, immediately. Atirusha, with great anger. Akshatam, without being hurt. Baka, Bakasura. Tundena, with his sharp beak. Hantum, to kill. Punaha, again. Adyapadyata, endeavored. Translation. Krishna, who was the father of Lord Brahma, but who was acting as the son of a cowherd man, became like fire, burning the root of the demon's throat. And the demon Bakasura immediately disgorged him. When the demon saw that Krishna, although having been swallowed, was unharmed, he immediately attacked Krishna again with his sharp beak. Purport by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Although Krishna is always as soft as a lotus, within the throat of Bakasura, he created a burning sensation of being hotter than fire. Although Krishna's whole body is sweeter than sugar candy, Bakasura tasted bitterness and therefore immediately vomited Krishna up. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, yeyatamam prapajyante tam stataiva bhajami aham. When Krishna is accepted as an enemy, he becomes the most intolerable object for the non-devotee who cannot tolerate Krishna within or without. Here, this is shown by the example of Bakasura. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskatari Shatarine. So I typically like to give a brief overview of where we are for those of us who haven't been attending daily or online, just to get a sense of the context of the verse. So this particular Bhagavatam chapter follows immediately after the story of Krishna's deliverance of the two demigods, Nalakuvera and Manigriva. And you might remember they had been cursed by Narada Muni to stand for thousands of years in the bodies of Arjuna trees. Krishna had been tied to a mortar between those two trees and pulled the trees down, which broke the spell of that curse by causing them to crash. Up until this point, there had been so many demons who had tried to kill Krishna that the cowherd men and women were feeling that Krishna's life was in danger due to the endless onslaughts on his life. Now this chapter, Childhood Pastimes of Krishna, begins by explaining how the wonderful childhood pastimes of Krishna seemed like miracles from the perspective of Nanda Maharaj, Mother Yashoda, and the other cowherd men and women. Because it seemed impossible that Krishna made it out alive each time he was attacked by so many demons. It just seemed miraculous. Prabhupada mentions in the summary of this chapter that the truth was that Krishna himself caused all these calamities to happen only to increase the parental affection of Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yashoda. In other words, Krishna deliberately arranged for so many calamities to happen in order to capture the attention of his parents and the community members that he lived with so that they would take greater shelter of him and think of him more and more deeply. And due to anxiety for Krishna's safety, the elders of Gokula, they all decided that the whole community should leave that place because they thought there were too many disturbances for them to continue to have a peaceful life to serve and worship Krishna. Prabhupada explains in one of the purports that a devotee only has one desire, and that is to be able to practice Krishna consciousness without any disturbance. And this was the case also with Krishna's devotees and associates living thousands of years ago. I remember, this must have been 20 years ago, when my husband and I were managing temples in Ireland, and we had just installed the first set of deities there named Radha Madhava, very large brass deities in the Dublin temple. And we got a message from an insider from the Irish government saying that in the coming week the Irish Secret Services was planning to raid the temple and confiscate all our vehicles, our properties, and desecrate the altar because in their view it was idol worship. Ireland at the time, and probably still is, for the most part, a Catholic country. And the increasing popularity of the Hare Krishna movement was very threatening to the Irish government. And like the cowherd people of Gokula, we were being harassed in so many ways by the Irish people because they saw our program of book distribution, chanting in the streets, and prasadam distribution. They saw that it was more attractive than any of their religious programs. In fact, we noticed that some of the churches tried to imitate some of our activities by having food, distributing food in church, which was usually pretty meager compared to what the Hare Krishna people were distributing. Something like pasta, mashed potatoes or something. And it didn't seem to have the same effect as our prasadam distribution because it wasn't really offered to Krishna.
Sometimes in those days, people would spit on the devotees while they were chanting on Hari Nam, or they would destroy our books while we were trying to distribute them, or the police would harass us in so many ways. Sometimes they'd take us down to the station, fingerprint us. I think it was very often the case in many parts of the world during that time. And like the cowherd men and women, we also thought, let us take the Radha Madhava deities to a safer place where they could be worshipped without any danger. Let us relocate and avoid so much harassment. Since we didn't know exactly when the Catholic agents were coming, we immediately packed up the deity paraphernalia and the deities and our Sankirtan vehicles, and we left for Northern Ireland in the middle of the night. We left a skeleton crew so that if and when they came, they would see, well, there's really nothing here to take. So Belfast is actually part of England, and Northern Ireland is kind of an English country, and there's a divide there. So we went out of Southern Ireland, actually went to another town. And like the cowherd men and women of Vrindavan, we soon realized that despite having moved to Belfast, there too were many obstacles and harassments from the people and from the government. So, in hindsight, as we reflected on that event, we realized that although the immediate cause was our moving Krishna out of Dublin to avoid the harassment of the Catholic Church, in fact, we realized that it was Krishna's way of bringing Krishna consciousness to Northern Ireland in Belfast. And it eventually led to us buying an island where we could bring people from Dublin and the cities out to the country where they could enjoy the beautiful home of Sri Sri Radha Govinda, who is now still situated there, very large Radha Govinda deities. So in this way, Krishna used the Catholic Church as a catalyst to get himself moved to Belfast, to close that Dublin temple, and to buy a large building in downtown Dublin where devotees could live in Radha Govinda's restaurant, which also became a very ideal preaching location. So sometimes we might see that Krishna, he closes one opportunity in order to point a devotee to a new and better opportunity for preaching. Although in the beginning it appeared that the devotees were responding to their anxiety to save the Hare Krishna movement, it turned out that all the seeming dangers resulted in an increase in the preaching. When Prabhupada was on the planet, he used to be very pleased when the Hare Krishna movement was written about in the newspapers. And even if it appeared to be bad press, his only interest was how many times the article mentioned Krishna's name. Even if it was saying bad things about Krishna, he didn't really care. He just wanted to see how many times the holy name was being seen and spoken. Now, one of the reasons that the cowherd people decided to move to Vrindavan was because it had lush plants, creepers, grass, that were suitable for feeding the cows and all the other animals. It also had nice gardens and tall mountains and all the facilities for happiness of all the cowherd men and women. And this is an ideal setting for people to practice Krishna consciousness in. Of course, living in a city like Los Angeles is prime. It's essential. It's a perfect place to preach the message of Krishna consciousness because there are tons of people everywhere. And so it makes it very easy for us to live here and to mingle with people and spread the holy name through book distribution and Harinam. But it's also for people trying to practice a Vedic lifestyle, it can be very, very wonderful to connect with Krishna in a natural surrounding. All of the stories in the Krishna book they come to life when you're surrounded by cows and plants and fresh air. So having made the decision to leave Gokula for a place where everyone in their community could practice Krishna conscious lifestyle without disturbance, the residents of Gokula, they packed up all their household belongings and they left that very day. This is also another very instructive few sentences that they packed up all their belongings, even though they had animals and they had pots and pans and whatever they had, they could pack it up in a few hours and put it on a buffalo cart and move. This is a good model for us, to be able to pack up all our belongings in just a few hours and load it on in a car, which is kind of the modern day cart, at a moment's notice. It doesn't matter if one is a household or a brahmachari. This model of Vaishnava life is to live simply with only what one needs to keep their body and soul together, just to serve Krishna, just enough to keep life going smoothly so they can serve Krishna. In verse 33, it describes that although the cowherd women had few possessions, what they did possess were of fine quality. And even today in Indian villages like Vrindavan, you will see that although people may have few possessions, what they do have is of very fine quality. I remember when I was living in Vrindavan, I often noticed that an entire family would go shopping to buy a single pot or a cooking utensil because they needed to choose something that would last for many generations. And therefore, each purchase was a group decision because the younger generation would inherit that pot or utensil. So although the cowherd men and women of Gokula didn't have much wealth in the form of hard currency or cash, what they did own was of high quality. I also observed that in Indian villages, most people didn't even have furniture in their homes, and they locked their possessions up in large metal trunks so that the monkeys and other rodents couldn't get to them, what to speak of the thieves. People lived like they were camping as a way of life all the time. Their lifestyle was not an endeavor to create a permanent, comfortable situation for themselves, because they knew we are just tourists in this material world, and we are only passing through for this one very short lifetime. And even the working class women of rural villages who carried bricks or cement on their heads at a building site, I noticed, they dressed in beautiful bright colored saris, earrings and bangles, even though they were engaged in hard labor for a living. Similarly, on their way to Vrindavan, Mother Yashoda and Rohini were also dressed in beautiful saris and bangles, and they looked very beautiful, although they were riding in the back of a bullock cart amidst all their pots and pans and household paraphernalia. They were completely satisfied with having little. They were little material possessions because they were completely absorbed in thinking about how they were going to serve Krishna and Balaram. They were busy recounting the activities of Krishna and Balaram. And therefore, they considered themselves wealthy because their consciousness was filled with love for them. So in these verses, it explains that Yashoda and Rohini were either engaged in physically taking care of Krishna and Balaram by cooking for them or bathing and dressing them or cleaning their living spaces, or they were talking about their activities. And in this way, they never felt any separation from Krishna and Balaram. This is also very instructive to us who live here in New Dwarka, because Krishna and Balaram have incarnated in this age as Lord Chaitanya and Nityananda, who are the most merciful incarnations of Krishna because they can deliver the most sinful person simply by chanting Krishna's holy names. In this age of Kali Yuga, Krishna advented in this material world as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, along with Balaram, appearing as Lord Nityananda. Lord Nityananda, or Balaram, in his most recent incarnation, took the role of Lord Chaitanya's principal associate for spreading the chanting of the holy names of Lord Krishna in the form of the Harinam Sankirtan. According to the teachings of the Acharyas, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu cannot be approached or understood without taking shelter of Nityananda Prabhu, who is the original guru of all the universes. And therefore, all the Acharyas in the Gaudiya Vaishnava lineage advocate the worship of Guru, Gauranga, who are incarnations of Krishna and Balaram, since Lord Nityananda is the original Guru, and Gauranga is another name for Lord Chaitanya. And just like Mother Yashoda and Rohini, who were either physically engaged in serving Krishna and Balaram by cooking for them or bathing and dressing them, or taking care of their living quarters or the community they lived in, or simply absorbed in hearing and discussing their various activities, the devotees of ISKCON can be engaged also this way in serving the community, in taking care of Krishna's devotees, in bathing and dressing the deities, and engaging in spreading the message of Lord Chaitanya. So back to the story. Once the cowherd men and women arrived to Vrindavan, they enjoyed some peace for a little while. And Krishna and Balaram, gradually they grew into youths who were now able to take care of the cows on their own, taking them out to herd, to graze in the pasturing grounds. But then other demons began to appear there also, and they also tried to kill Krishna in so many ways. Like there was a calf demon who embedded himself in the herd of calves Krishna and Balaram were taking care of. This calf demon thought that his real identity was disguised by his taking the form of a calf. But Krishna knew immediately that this particular calf was not a true member of his herd of calves. So he indicated his awareness to Balaram by using a sign. We don't know what kind of sign Krishna used to communicate this to Balaram. Perhaps he winked at him, or he nodded his head, but he did something that made Balaram aware that there was an enemy in their camp. And sometimes we see that a person of demoniac mentality, he tries to embed themselves in the devotee community, pretending to be a devotee in order to solve their economic problems or to take advantage of the facilities they see the devotees have, and they want to have those facilities without taking shelter of Krishna. And they are simply envious of Krishna. And Prabhupada noticed that as the movement got larger, he from time to time would say, there are demons in our camp. Be aware. Prabhupada used to often comment on materialistic people who were envious of the devotees. Sometimes newspaper reporters would criticize Prabhupada for being picked up at the airport in a Rolls Royce, or for sitting on a high seat like the Vyasa-san, not understanding the purpose of the way we live and our values. A common question he was asked by non-devotees was how devotees could live in such an opulent building without having to work. In the old days, people used to shout, "Get a job!" when they'd see the devotees distributing books on Harinam, not realizing that Krishna was their job, serving Krishna was their job, that was their job, and that Krishna was reciprocating with their service by giving them shelter. So today's verse is a description of the killing of the most recent demon who appeared on the scene while Krishna and the cowherd boys and calves were drinking water at a reservoir. This demon happened to be in the form of a huge duck with a large beak who opened his mouth wide and swallowed Krishna whole right before the cowherd boys' eyes. And naturally, the cowherd boys, seeing Krishna being devoured in such a way by a huge animal, Balaram and the cowherd boys became filled with horror and anxiety. Prabhupada explains that although Balaram had the strength to do anything, because of his intense affection for Krishna, for a moment he was bewildered by the incident. And we see this again and again in the Krishna Leela, that the close associates of Krishna, due to their affection for Krishna, sometimes become confused temporarily by not understanding how Krishna is working in their lives. Sometimes it appears that there is devastation all around, but over time they realize that what happened was essential for their advancement in Krishna consciousness. So Krishna always emerges victorious in the end. So in this verse, Krishna manifested himself like fire in the throat of the demon Bakasura, who coughed him up just to get free from that burning sensation in his throat. And even after coughing Krishna up out of his throat, Bakasura didn't stop his attack on Krishna. Rather, he again tried to attack Krishna with his large beak. Prabhupada explains in the purport that despite Krishna's being softer than a lotus and sweeter than sugar candy, The demon Bakasura experienced him as bitter tasting, and so he vomited up Krishna because he was so repulsed by him. And that's what happens when you're envious of Krishna. You have no taste. The Krishna Katha is bitter. It doesn't move your heart. There's a nice story in Srimad Bhagavatam that illustrates this point. In Canto 9, I believe it's text number 4, there's a description of an incident that happened to Maharaj Ambarish. Maharaj Ambarish was the most powerful and celebrated devotee of the planet. He was the king of the world at the time. And even though he had so much opulence, he was so humble. He considered all his opulence to be simply temporary assets. His knowing that such material opulence was the cause of downfall into conditional life made him unattached to all that opulence. So King Ambarish engaged his senses and mind in the service of the Lord, and because he had so much opulence, he performed his devotional service with great opulence, and therefore, despite his wealth, he had no attachment to his wife, his children, or his kingdom. He didn't even desire liberation. So one day, Maharaj Ambarish was worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead in Vrindavan, observing the vow of Dwadasi, the time following Ekadashi day when a person has to break their fast. We do this every Ekadashi, the day after. There's a certain time that's announced after Mangal Arati when we should take grains. And at that moment, when Maharaj Ambarish was about to break his fast, the great mystic yogi Durvasa Muni appeared in the house, and he became his guest. Of course, we know from Vedic culture the guest is God. So Ambarish knew that, and he wanted to take care of him nicely. So he respectfully received Durvasa Muni, and Durvasa Muni, after accepting his invitation to eat there, he went to bathe in the Yamuna at noontime. Because Durvasa Muni was absorbed in samadhi, he did not come back very soon. So Maharaj Ambarish, seeing the time to break his fast had arrived, drank water in accordance with the advice of learned brahmanas, just to observe the formality of breaking the fast. Through his mystic power then, I mean, he wasn't there physically, he could understand that Maharaj Ambarish had taken water before he broke his fast, and he became very angry, because it's proper etiquette for a host not to take food or drink before satisfying their guest, who is God, or representing God. So when Durvasa Muni returned to the palace, he chastised Maharaj Ambarish and became so angry that he created from his hair a demon appearing like the fire of death. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, however, who is always the protector of his sincere devotees, sent out his Sudarshan Chakra, which immediately destroyed the fiery demon, and then began to chase Durvasa Muni, who was envious of Ambarish Maharaj. Now, feeling himself being burned by Krishna's Sudarshan Chakra in this way, Durvasa began to run to Shivaloka and Brahmaloka and all the other higher planets, seeking protection from the wrath of Krishna's Sudarshan Chakra. But he could not find any shelter anywhere or relief from the burning sensation from the Sudarshan Chakra. Just like Bakasura, he was envious. And he had this burning sensation Krishna made to have him suffer his consequences of his envy. Eventually, Durvasa Muni went to the spiritual world and he surrendered to Lord Narayan. But Lord Narayan said he could not excuse a person who had offended a Vaishnava, telling him that in order to be excused from such an offense, he must submit himself to the Vaishnava whom he has offended and beg his forgiveness. Prabhupada explains in this purport that when a person offends a Vaishnava, they naturally feel anxiety, which is experienced as a burning sensation in their consciousness. And that anxiety is actually directly caused by Krishna as a means of compelling the offending person to ask for forgiveness from the person who they have offended. So, sometimes, like in this story of Krishna's killing of Bakasura, Krishna instills within a demon who is envious of him a burning anxiety that kills their demonic mentality and brings them to their knees. or makes them go mad. There's a story in the Raya of Vishnu, the story of the life of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, several parts to that. But there's a story in there that I never forget because it impressed me so much. That Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he had a son by his first wife who died very early. And when he was in his early 30s, he suddenly became insane. He was married, he had a couple of small children, and all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, he goes mad. And no one could understand in the family of Bhaktivinoda Thakur what had happened to cause him to go mad. And after a few years, his physical health was deteriorating so badly, it looked to everyone as though he was dying. So all the families of Bhaktivinoda Thakur gathered round his bed, chanting for him in anticipation of his death. And as they were chanting, they noticed that the mark of a tilak started to appear and glow on his forehead. Gradually, he came back to consciousness, and he began to speak to the people that were surrounding his bed. It's described in this book that his body started to glow. And he said very clearly, "The reason I went insane was due to an offense I made to a local brahmana, and the reason I came back to my senses was due to all of your pure chanting of the holy name." So both of these stories are very instructive to us regarding ways we can destroy our devotional service by offending a Vaishnava who has dedicated their life to the service of Krishna. And the way to get free from such offenses, number one, to continue to ask for forgiveness for one's offenses to the Vaishnavas, and two, to keep oneself in the association of devotees who chant the holy name without offense. We might not be able to chant without offense ourselves, but if we're even sitting in the assembly of devotees who are chanting, there's likely to be one person at that time who's chanting without offense. And that can be very beneficial for us. Even if we're so in Maya, we can do nothing but just sit in the assembly of devotees. So I'm going to stop here. I'm aware of the time, and I know there might be questions or comments. So are there any questions or comments? And Savas is smiling back there. What are you thinking? What's coming up in you? Any thoughts? Anybody need a microphone, I guess?
Who are you calling on first?
Huh?
Who are you calling on?
Savas.
Hare Krishna. Thank you. A lot of information.
Yeah, I know. I have too much information.
Wonderful stories and a lot of information, but I think I enjoy the history, just getting a little bit of a history.
Thank you.
But basically, there's everything you said is very Krishna conscious, and everything was very, it brought back memories to me about being a devotee in the very beginning.
Yeah.
And things that you said is true across the board, I should say, in the movement at that time. But I'm thinking also, as you were speaking, that if you see the endeavor that the devotees made in those days,
Yeah. People
like yourself, your husband, we're reaping the benefits of that today because of the sincerity that was instilled by us through Srila Prabhupada. You can see that purity, it produced what we see today.
Yeah.
Following the instruction of Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah.
And just endeavoring. And you also made me think how a lot of ladies in the ISKCON movement in those days today are very special. I think I learned that about 30 years later. But, you know, I'm just thinking as I was hearing that how special the ladies were in this movement in that particular time and place. Because in those days, everything was rampant. Meaning, you know, there was unrestricted sex. There was intense enjoyment. Yeah. There were so many, you know, the world was just full of sense gratification. And I have to say that the ladies that joined this movement at that particular time period, to put on a sari, you know, to wear a sari and put it over your head and wear it every day, and it was incredible. ladies in those particular mothers, they gave their children to Gurukul school. They abandoned all those things. They even went so far as to just completely surrender to Srila Prabhupada and practically speaking work right with their husband or even better than their husband. And this is what you made me think about today when I heard you speaking.
Well, thank you. It's nice to reminisce. We have a lot of history, and in a lot of ways, our history, I know why Prabhupada thought of the movement as this is the Vrindavan community in some ways, and so we really can learn from Cowherd Boys and Cowherd
Senior Vaishnavis that
thank you for the advertisement. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Yeah. What else? He had his hand up next, and he needs a
so much, Mata. I have two questions. They are small ones, hopefully. So one of them was, so we hear about Nanda Maharaja's palace or Rishabhana's palace. Were the palace empty? It's like how can you wrap up the whole palace in a few hours? Or were they palace? Or this is our mood to approach that village community in the reverential mood. That's the first one. Then the second one, this is an ashram question. Why Shias do not go to Gurukul? That's my question.
Why did what?
Why Shias?
Vaishyas did not go to Gurukul?
That's the Varnashram question. I don't know.
I believe there's some record of Krishna going to Gurukul. No? Huh? As a kshatriya. Help me out, those of you who do a lot of more reading than me.
After Gurukul, they just took on the service of their father. In other words, the Gurukul was there after they graduated from Gurukula. The culture was that the son would immediately go into the same service or work that his father was involved
in. Right, right.
So they were cowherd men and women. So Krishna just followed his father's activities, father's work, and became a cowherd boy.
Yeah.
After Gurukul.
And that's kind of how it is even today. You'll see in an Indian village, the guy, merchant, his sons are in the shop. And their laboring class, the kids are on the work side. So, about the palaces, I have no idea. I really don't. Maybe somebody can. Oh, good. You're going to tell it. I don't know.
Well, first of all, Srila Prabhupada mentions not once but a number of times that the cowherd community was not poor in any respect. Actually, they were very opulent. In fact, he illustrates that by the fact that they had lots of milk and they had lots of butter, and when Krishna was appeared or brought to Gokul, they were having like a party, so to speak, and they were throwing this butter and throwing yogurt all over the place as if they didn't care, even though it was very valuable. They would use that. That's what they used to get wealthy. They sold their butter, they sold their yogurt, they sold cheese, anything to do, and different types of farm items. So in one sense, they had the bangles and rings and necklaces and all of these things, and especially on special occasions, they just dressed up and showed those particular things. So we speak of palace. Palace can mean mansion. Palace can mean a very opulent building. It has all the things that we consider to be very respectable or venerable or admirable. So, but not a palace in the sense of Kamsa's palace. We shouldn't think in those terms. We have to think in a more modest type of palace, which is still, as I said, has a certain degree of richness and opulence, and there's no, they're never needy. That's the main point. They had plenty to eat, and whatever they traded, they got all the jewels and adornments that they needed. They had all the cows had all the fresh grasses on Govardhan Hill. So there was never any sense of lack or need. Everything was supplied there. And that in itself is opulence, because who doesn't have some need at some point, but with Krishna present, Krishna was there to make sure that all their needs were satisfied unless there was some reason to do otherwise.
Good.
So that's my understanding of the opulence.
Yeah, and it could be, I mean, I know when I went to Ladakh, the palaces were... They were kind of adobe, you know, very fancy mud homes, you know, that were so just very opulent. Whatever they had could be an opulent mud hut. Who knows? Anybody else have a comment? Yeah, Sachi. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So you were speaking about forgiveness and approaching others for forgiveness that may have been offended. So I know for myself, I've offended people through the years. I offend people now. And it would seem that it would take me an extremely long time to go around and to ask different people for forgiveness. And it also seems that by doing so, I would be giving my... I don't want to say giving my power away, but I'm really leaving it up to other people to forgive me. And so my question is, what can I do as opposed to approaching all different people? Because then I'd be going to everybody. So what can I do then as an individual to ask for forgiveness or to maybe to forgive myself for those things that I've done to other Vaishnavas and even other people who are not even devotees?
I would say, and I'm open to any other comments on this, that, yeah, we're offending people all the time, whether we know it or not. Often we don't know it. But we came to this material world because we wanted to enjoy separate from Krishna. And I've had the realization to get out of this material world, we kind of have to grovel. We have to be the servant of everyone. We have to, when we take the attitude of servant of everyone, it's also a way of, if someone has been offended by us, of saying, I'm sorry. It's putting feet to, instead of going around and saying, forgive me for my offenses, we do that, and I think it's appropriate to do that if you're aware. But if you don't know who exactly you've offended, and you feel like you're offending all the time, it's always good to put a straw in your teeth and just be really humble and recognize that even if a person isn't aware how you've... They may not even be consciously aware that what you did was offensive, but Super Soul sees it. Sees it in your heart and sees it in their heart. And Krishna also will forgive you if you come to others in a mood of submission and surrender and service. Yeah, okay. He's got the right answer.
You know, every morning we say Vancha Kalpa Trubhyasya Kipas Nivyata. We say that every morning. So come every morning, stay after Mangal Arati.
There you go.
Vancha Kalpa Trubhyasya. You'll do a good job of asking forgiveness for every devotee that's there.
Yeah, in the good old days, we used to actually bow down to every single devotee, but then it got to be hundreds of devotees. It got to be a bit much. But didn't we? We used to do that. You see in Vaishnava, you're offering obeisances every day, every time you saw them. Yeah.
So there, it seems that there's room for forgiving oneself as well. Can you speak a little bit about forgiving oneself?
Well, self-compassion is important. I mean, we're making mistakes all the time. And awareness of those mistakes is really, really important for us to make progress. But if you get too complacent about those offenses, you might be in deep doo-doo. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, another on that particular point, if you just say, remind ourselves about the prayer to Tulsi Devi.
Mm.
So if you worship Tulsi Devi, you can become purified even up to killing a brahmana.
Oh, good.
So if you go to Tulsi Puja every day, so first it's Vancha Kalpa Trubhyasya, and then you just go to Tulsi Puja every day, no matter what simple activity you may have committed, by worshiping her with real love and devotion, you'll become purified.
There you go.
Now, I think Sachin Anoy, did you want to say something? Oh, Mara, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to make one point regarding forgiving oneself. This is a very dangerous thing to do. And it's dangerous because as soon as I commit an offense and I say, well, you know, I forgive myself because I really didn't mean it, or it was just an impulse and so forth, it gives you the right to commit it again and again. Because every time you say you forgive yourself, it means that it's okay. But it's not okay. And that wonderful story that you told, when Durvasa Muni went to Lord Vishnu, he didn't say to him, you just forgive yourself, and that's okay. He said, you go to King Ambarish, you throw yourself at his feet, you beg for his forgiveness, and if he gives you his forgiveness, then you are free from this, you see. This requires an extra notch up of humility. Very often we don't like to lower ourselves or forgive ourselves, especially when a person like Durvasa Muni, who was so high and mighty with all his mystical powers, here he is going to a king, you see, who doesn't even have any of the powers that he has, although in the realest sense, the truest sense, he has more power because he has the mercy of Krishna always behind him. But Durvasa Muni never knew that or understood that, and now he actually does understand that the greatest power that a devotee, a person can have, is to have the backing of the Supreme Lord, as was manifested through the Chusudarshan Chakra and Lord Vishnu, etc. So the important point is that we don't forgive ourselves. Rather, we beg for the forgiveness of. And if we can't find, let's say 10 lives ago, I cut somebody's throat or something like that, well, and I haven't paid the price for that. No, I don't forgive myself. I beg the Lord, please. I know I have committed millions and billions of offenses which I have not even apologized for, and I can't even find those persons. And I beg you, who are all powerful and have all gracious and all loving, you have the power to forgive me. And I beg for that forgiveness, making clear to you that I would never want to do whatever I have done, which was evil, sinful, wrong, no good, again. So please forgive me for that.
I see Sachin Anoy and Brigapati, and I'm aware of the time, so be quick if you can, because I know people are hungry.
But Amala Bhaktamara said, I think actually you made a really good point in your class about you're not going to know who you've offended, who you didn't offend, and sometimes the person. But if you have that attitude of serving everybody, that's an important thing.
Yeah.
And Krishna, you know, he sees the attitude. Bhava Grihi Janard, attitude is everything in devotional service. And just the thing I actually wanted to add was, Chanaka Pandit says you could take gold from a filthy place. Okay, so before I was a devotee, I read this book by Aldous Huxley. I think it was Brave New World or something like that.
Yeah, I read it too.
But something he said stuck in my mind, and I memorized it. And it's very relevant to this point. He said, most moralists are agreed that remorse is a very regrettable sentiment. If you have behaved badly in the past, repent, make what amends you can, and address yourself to the task of behaving better in the future. Rolling in the muck is not the best way to get clean. So, you know, we shouldn't roll in the muck. You know, we should forgive ourselves to the extent that we don't roll in the muck, but then we have to have a positive program for counteracting these offenses.
So it's not just about in the mind. It has to be something practical, just like if you offer food in the mind, you should eat it in the mind as well. So, if if there needs to be a physical behavior change.
Right.
Sachin Anoy, are you done? Okay. Oh, I think we have to stop, but if you want to come over here, we can talk about this. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.